For more than 80 years, the Society of Financial Service Professionals has been helping individuals, families, and businesses achieve financial security. Society members have earned recognized professional credentials in the financial services industry or are working towards attaining those professional credentials. Since the beginning of the Grant Taggart Symposium, the Utah chapter of the Society of Financial Services Professionals has been a co-sponsor of this event. Please welcome the Vice President of the Utah chapter, Bill Gallagher.
As we were putting the program together, I asked for just a couple minutes to talk about the organization. So that page 24 and 25 in the program of the members of the organization. I just want to talk to you a little bit about what we do and encourage all of you to attend a luncheon and join the Society of Financial Services Professionals. What we do in that organization, I'm a member of NAFA as well, been a NAFA member for 28 years. We're going to talk to you about joining NAFA tomorrow. This is an organization that we want you to join in addition to NAFA, not in replacement of NAFA. As I mentioned, I am a member of both. It's for people that have achieved their designations, their CLU, their CHFCs, their CFPs. We have accountants. We have attorneys that are members of the organization. And we do a little bit more advanced planning. If you want to get into a little bit more sophisticated planning, you want to up your clientele, get involved with better types of people, and hopefully increase your income, this is the organization that you want to be involved in. If you do not have those designations, you probably ought to be – let me rephrase that. You ought to be working on those designations. And as a student, you can still be a member of the Society of Financial Services Professionals. There's a great networking opportunity as well, because we do have accountants, we have attorneys in there. Most of the people, I run an agency in town, and most of my agents do not have relationships with CPAs, do not have relationships with attorneys that they are referring business back and forth to. How are you going to build those relationships? This organization can help foster those. We meet five times a year. Our next meeting is November 10th. We meet at the Joseph Smith Memorial Building downtown. It's not the most. I know some of you are in Ogden. I was talking to some people from Idaho Falls just a moment ago. I know we've got some people that come in from Las Vegas and Boise and Wyoming. So it's not always the most. So don't have a chapter in every town, but it's every other month. Make a trip in and join us for lunch. You know, every other month, five times a year, you can do that. There's also what we call sections meetings. What sections are study groups where you get together in certain areas on estate planning, on retirement planning, if that's an area you really want to work in. Get with people that are really involved in that and learn from them. Again, it's a good opportunity for you to develop your business. It costs about $320 to be a member. I know it's only $320. Everything's only $300. But you really ought to join the organization. Join us for lunch. The information, just go to the website. You can call up me. As you look through the program and the names, you probably know somebody whose name is there. Contact them. If you are a member and you have not been attending the luncheons, please come join us again. The programs this year are, without a doubt, the best programs we've ever had. I'm in charge of programs. So hopefully they're as good anyway as they have been in the past. So I hope to see you all there, and I don't want to take any more time. So see you November 10th.
We're very pleased to have Guy Baker with us today. Guy has been in the business many years, has an advisory firm called BTA Advisory Group, which works with wealthy families and owners of closely held businesses. But Guy is also a member of the Advanced Association of Life Underwriters, AALU, which is a Washington, D.C.-based organization that advocates for our industry in the Congress. In 2000, Guy became the president of Million Dollar Roundtable Foundation, and in 2006 was elected secretary of the executive committee. He comes to us as the new president of MDRT. From the information, you might think that Guy is inaccessible, but I have a few facts that I want to give to you about Guy that might make him a little more reachable to you. His favorite food, we found out, is anything fattening, especially Mexican food. His favorite movie is Lady and the Tramp, and one of his favorite hobbies is playing the piano, which the other hobby he has is golf. He was able to go golfing yesterday. We're still waiting to hear him play the piano. Would you please join with me in welcoming Guy Baker here for the second time?
Thank you. Well, this is indeed intimidating to follow such great speakers as we've had this morning, and I hope that the time that we'll share together will be worthwhile for you. Thank you for all of you participating in the Grant Taggart Symposium. This has been something that I've watched for a number of years. Rulon Rasmussen's a dear friend of mine, and I know he and John have worked very hard to... What did you say, John? This is the 21st year? So it's great to see all continuing to support this. What I would like to do this morning is to share with you my journey. And I think... Okay, perfect. And, you know, how many of you are actively in sales in this audience? So the vast majority of you. Well, that's great. So I'll be speaking right to your hearts. My journey started in 1960 when I was in college. And as a result of being in college, I had an opportunity to walk into my room. And when I walked into my room, here was a life insurance agent talking to my roommate. And I said, gee, that's interesting. Why don't you come talk to me? And so he came back and sold me a policy, and about 6 months later came to me and said, you know, would you like to represent us on campus? And so that was the beginning of my career. I did a summer program, and during that summer program, it led to sales during my senior year. And then when I graduated in my senior year, they gave me a management program that I could go to grad school on. And then when I got done with graduate school, I was face-to-face with a decision. What was I going to do with the rest of my life? You know, when you think about your career and how you got to be in this room and how you happened to be sitting here with the number of years of experience, you have to ask yourself, what is success? You know, how do you define success? And there's, you can define it by the measure, by a standard that others give you, or you can define it by your own standard. The first few years that I was in the business, I defined it by the standard of others. But I soon found out that unless I had my own standard, unless I applied my own standard to what I thought I needed to do in order to be, to achieve my objectives and to be successful in this business, that I was going to be empty, that my values were not going to be the driver because I was going to be so focused on what others wanted me to do. You know, success can be measured as a top producer. It can be measured by the number of policies. It can be measured by material wealth. It can be measured by the vacations you take. I mean, there's a number of different ways, you know, how big your portfolio is. But I think we all know, and certainly it would be my expectation being up here in Utah, that most of us in this room understand that there are values that drive our lives that are far greater than anything material in this world. Now, John had asked me to speak specifically about the Million Dollar Roundtable. Now, I don't know if you, how many are members of the Million Dollar Roundtable in this room? Oh, quite a few. Great. Fabulous. Well, if you saw those hands rise and you talked to them, they would tell you probably exactly the same thing I would tell you. The first, when I, as I mentioned to you, I was face-to-face with a decision, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But when I came into the business full-time in 1970 and became an agent, the very first thing I was told was you have to become a member of the Million Dollar Roundtable. Now, being very dutiful as I am and obedient, that became my objective. And so I worked hard to make the Million Dollar Roundtable the first year I was in the business. But I didn't go to a meeting for 5 years. But what I did do was I read the proceedings from cover to cover every year. And one of the things that always caught my attention were the profiles, the biographies. And you can learn a lot about people from their biographies, seeing the path that they've taken and how they have built their careers to be where they are today. And so the time that I'm with you this morning, I'd like to kind of share with you my path. In the workshop this afternoon, tomorrow, I'll talk more about sales ideas, things that I've learned. But as it relates to my biography, I think some of the things, some of the lessons that I've learned in that transition from a standard that was set by others to a standard that became my standard might be of interest to you. Well, why MDRT? Well, one of the reasons for MDRT is professional growth. I mean, one of the great things about coming to an MDRT meeting is that you get to hear great speakers like Mel this morning. That, and I don't know if you've ever spoken at Roundtable, but great speakers like Mel giving wonderful ideas that can help you build your practice. But there's also community. You know, there's a community of MDRT people that reach out and touch each other throughout the year if you want to avail yourselves of that. Another opportunity is to gain professional perspective. And this was probably the single most important thing that happened to me was when I came to the Roundtable, I was able to get outside myself and I was able to see the profession in a much different way than I had ever seen it before. And I'll share that with you in a little bit. And then finally, leadership. You know, there's lots of leadership opportunities in NAFA, in the professional associations, here within the Taggart Symposium. But, you know, working on a national scale or an international scale and learning some of the leadership skills that we've been taught in my 25 years of volunteering with the Roundtable have paid numerous dividends in my profession. So let me tell you a little bit about my background. I don't want to bore you with this. You know, we all have our resumes, but it might give you some perspective on my biography. I started, like I say, in the business in 1966, and I was a career agent with the Pacific Life. I led that company in sales for 10 years. I've been top of the table for 32 years, you know, company Hall of Fame, estate planners, distinguished, you know, professional, and on, you know, I mean, there's no dearth of recognition in this business if you survive a long time, right? But what does that mean? You know, when I walk into my house, I can guarantee you that none of my children cared one twit about any of that, you know? And the last person that ever paid any attention to how many times I qualified for the top of the table was my wife. When you walk into the real world, you know, not this fantasy world that we live in, the recognition. What is it that's important? What is it that drives your heart? What is it that drives your lives? Anyway, as I mentioned to you, in 1967, when I graduated from college, I had started on an MBA program, and that was a result of having, you know, done the college program. And then in 1968, when I graduated, I started to interview for a job. So I went to Alcoa, I went to several banks, I went to a major insurance company. You know, I did the whole interviewing thing. I mean, I was an MBA. I had graduated from college or from grad school. They were offering me about a third of what I was earning part-time selling life insurance. And I said, you know, there's something about this that I just don't understand. And of course, I think, you know, Mel was talking about his dad. My mom was not pleased. You know, when I told my mother I was going to be a life insurance agent, that was not something that resonated through the halls of our house. You know, she had no need for insurance. She wanted a banker or an attorney. That was why she struggled to put me through college. But as it were, you know, I did what I wanted to do anyway. In 1970, like I said, I qualified for the MDRT. And I'll tell you, that was a struggle. Qualifying for the MDRT that first year. I remember getting up to December 15th and being that short. The reason I share that with you is because I really wondered whether or not I could be successful. You know, you go through college, you go through high school, you know, you live your life, but when you're out in the business world, you know, have you ever wondered whether you could be successful? Have you ever wondered whether or not you could survive in the financial services industry? You know, Mel was talking about, or maybe it was his introduction, was talking about being on straight commission. You know, you watch these hawks and eagles, they're on straight commission, right? We only eat when we make sales, when we're successful. And so I had been drilled into my brain that I had to make $1 million Roundtable that first year, and I was that short, and that was my measure of success. Well, as it turned out, I made it. You know, just was able to get over the line. I celebrated for 2 months and started in February of 71 behind the eight ball again and got right up to December of 71. And you had to make MDRT 2 years in a row to be an MDRT member in those days. And so everything that I had dreamed about, everything that I had thought about, everything that was important to me was on the line in those last 2 weeks. And I came face to face with that fear of success again. And that really opened my eyes to something. And what it opened my eyes to more than anything else was, you know, we can have a fear of failure, but some of, you know, I found within myself, and I have found this in talking with other people, some of us fear success. Some of us don't want to be, you know, in a position where they have to be held accountable, where they have set the bar so high that they've got to be able to do it the next year and the next year, and to have those types of accountabilities in their lives. And I really wondered whether or not that was something that I was going to have to struggle with. Well, as it turned out, I made it, and I've made it every year since. So I think I've been a member. This will be my 40th year as a member of the Roundtable. Well, in 1976, they came out with, or 75, they came out with Top of the Table, and I didn't make it. Of course, I didn't know about it. So, you know, had to know about it to make it. And I just missed it by a little bit. The next year, I made it. The next year, I missed it. And it was kind of that same fear of success again. And then I made it the next year, and I've made it every year since then. Let's go here. Now, I was told three things when I started in the business. Number one was I had to make club in the company, Pacific Life. I had to make MDRT, and I had to get a designation. And so I had my CLU by 1972. And I thought, okay, I am done. You know, I don't need any more education. I've got a college degree. I got an MBA. And I've got a CLU. What else do I need? And so I put my head down, and I started to concentrate on selling. And I got flat, you know, and I realized I had no stimulus. I realized that I had nothing that was really prodding me intellectually in the business. So I started to, get involved in some of the other designations. And so if you saw all the letters after my name, you'd realize how obsessive compulsive I can really be. In 82, though, I came to a place where I had read Maltz's Psycho-Cybernetics when I was younger, and I realized that you had to keep readjusting your goals and objectives, but somehow or another, that didn't happen to me. And so when I hit 1980, I had a 10-year goal that I blew by. And all of a sudden, everything that I had set, everything that I had wanted to accomplish, I was beyond it, and I had no goals at that point in time. And I had to readjust everything that I wanted to do going forward. And that sent me into a spin, and it set me up for what happened in 1982, which was when I merged with another agent and we started a company together. Well, in 1986, that turned out to be a disaster. We merged with an international property and casualty firm. We were doing business around the United States and territories. We were working with public companies. I put in executive compensation programs with a number of name companies that you would know. And in 86, it all fell apart. And I'll tell you a little bit about why it fell apart in a minute. And then we reemerged with a new passion, became investment advisors in 92 and started managing money. In 2000, JR mentioned MDRT. President of the foundation, and XCOM, which was kind of going along behind that. And then we're here today. I guess, you know, one of the most important messages, and again, being in Utah, I know I don't have to say this to many of you in the room, but, you know, there's no success in the office that can compensate for a failure at home. And I probably heard that the first time from John Savage. If any of you ever have heard John passed away a number of years ago, but he was a very successful agent and shared a lot of his life and his sales ideas with people for years and years and years. And at that point in time, I guess, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but I've been married four times. Of course, it's all been to the same woman. We just celebrated 42 years of marriage. But you know, we went through different phases in our relationship. And as we went through those different phases in our relationship, it caused us to reassess who we were, you know, as a family, as well as, you know, who I was in my business and who we were as parents. We have four children. Stacy is our oldest. She's 39. And then we have a son, 37, Todd. And then I have a son, Andrew, who's 29, and a daughter, 27, Ellen. Now, Ellen works with me, and we have 10 grandchildren, and the oldest grandchild works with me. He got licensed the day he turned 18. He just left for a mission trip to Africa. So we're, you know, quite pleased to see that his spiritual side is developing here. But, you know, so that's our family. And, you know, the 86 experience really contributed significantly to not only our development as a family, but our development in the business world. And I would have to say that if it were not for the $1 Million Roundtable, and if it had not been for the relationships that I had built in the $1 Million Roundtable, you know, I'm not sure the story would be the same today that it is. And it was that support system, that community that I mentioned to you before. Now, to kind of rewind a little bit, when I joined the Roundtable, I didn't go to a meeting until 1975. So I was a member for 5 years. I read the proceedings. I read the, you know, the biographies. You know, I inculcated myself into the MDRT system. But what happened in 1975 was they put the meeting so close to me, I had no excuse. I had to go. It was I could afford to go. And so I drove up, and it was huge. I mean, it was an enormous meeting. It was bigger than anything I'd ever been to in my life. I think there had to be at least 1,200 people there. Now, if anybody knows about Roundtable, we've had as many as 7,000 and 8,000 in recent years, right? But to me, it was enormous. And I couldn't plug in. I just didn't feel connected to it. And I remember the last day I was sitting in main platform. There's usually 4 days of main platform. And I'd had a pretty good year. I think that was, you know, like my fifth year in the business. And I think I'd finished like fourth in Pacific Life or whatever. And so I'm sitting there, and we're waiting for main platform to sit. And I turn over to the guy on the left, and we start talking. I said, well, how much business did you do last year? And he said, he gave me a number that was like 2 to 3 times more than what I'd done. So I kind of went like this and turned over to the other guy. I figured, you know, what's the chances of me sitting between two people that did more business than me, right? I needed to feel good about myself. So I turned to this fellow on the other side who has since turned out to be a really dear friend, and we've gotten to know each other through the years. 10 times what I had done. And I'm going, What? You know, are they telling me the truth? Is that, you know? And all of a sudden, you know, my mind opened up so much more, you know, from having been there, from having talked to people, from having had that experience, that when I went home, you know, all of a sudden my vision of the world was significantly different. Well, fast forward then, and I ended up, by the way, making a commitment to come back, but only because I had gone to a CLU institute and I met Gene Mon at that CLU institute, who became president, I think, of the Roundtable in 2000. And he convinced me that I needed to come back. And so we formed a study group, and that became part of our community. So it was part of that community and this thing that I was telling you about with the property and casualty firm that led me to come face to face with probably the single biggest issue ethically that I had to deal with in my career, and that was compromise. You know, I realized that as honest as I wanted to be, as truthful as I wanted to be, where's Quinn? as direct as I wanted to be, I had allowed myself to make a decision that was totally against my principles. And I had gotten into business with people that I didn't want to be in business with. And so in working that whole thing through, we ended up basically having to start fresh. Whole new book of business, whole new clients, everything in 1986. Now, all of the employees that worked for us at that time came with me. And so, you know, I have employees that have been with me 26 years. A couple of them have been with me 26 years. One's been with me 20 years. A couple have been with me 18, 19 years, 16 years. I mean, we've got a group that's been, I have 10 employees. and we've been together for a long time. But the genesis was this business failure. And what I learned about myself in that business failure was the fact that, you know, my principles were far more important than the money that I was making. That I had to be comfortable and confident about what we were doing and the work that we were doing for clients far more than I needed to worry about, you know, the amount of business that we were doing or whether I was working for another organization or I was in partnership. And in fact, I built a principle at that point in time which said no more partners. I was not going to have any more partners in the business. I didn't want anybody in a direct affiliation with me that could affect my bottom line. Now, that doesn't mean I don't do joint work. That doesn't mean I don't have alliances. That doesn't mean that I don't have business relationships. But there's nobody that directly impacts my bottom line other than me. So as a result of that, though, I was in two lawsuits. And if anybody remembers 1986, that was when they changed the tax law and all of the tax deductions went away. Well, we had, as an outside venture, I had been involved in some real estate development. All of that collapsed. We had bank loans that were monumental that had to get paid off with no source of repayment. The church that I belonged to collapsed, and my marriage was in turmoil. And the two oldest children went into drug alcohol rehab at 14 and 16. So that was my world in 1986. And it was at that point in time when I realized that whatever path I was on was not the path I wanted to stay on. That was when I realized that I needed to make some major changes in my life. Now, you have to understand that at that point in time, it wasn't like I didn't have a spiritual life. It's not like we weren't, you know, actively involved in our church. It wasn't like, my deal with my wife was I worked Monday through Friday, and she got Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays. So, you know, the family got 3 days a week. The business got 4 days a week. So, you know, there was plenty of family time. I would be able to take off, go to the kids, functions, plays, games, you know, whatever all that was. So, I was not an absent father by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, for whatever the reasons were, and I don't have time to go into it right now, you know, we had problems with those two older children. I was telling somebody last night at dinner, when I walked into the house at night with my 13-year-old daughter, from the minute she changed from 12 to 13, I had to walk in with raw meat, a whip, and a chair. Whatever that hormone switch was that hit between age 12 and age 13, I'm not sure exactly what it was. Now, today, she's a beautiful woman. She's got four children. She's a great mom. You know, we're very blessed. But it was a disaster. So anyway, the bottom line is that that's what I had to live with. So I had to maintain my world, go through the rehab, try and rebuild my relationship with my wife, solve all those financial problems. And I could not have done that. I guarantee you, I could not have done that alone. And if I had walked totally and completely alone, it would have been impossible. But because of my spiritual faith, because of the support group that I had, we were able to make it through that. So, like I said, a reassessment of life, a reassessment of success, a reassessment of goals, and an understanding of, you know, the difference between success and significance. Maybe some of you have read Bob Buford's book called Halftime. It's a great discussion of what happens when people finally get to the place where they start asking the question, you know, what's it all about? Why am I doing what I am doing? And is this really the best investment of my life? So, some of the things that I learned. First off, you have to have a philosophy. Do you have a philosophy? Do you have a philosophy for how you deal with your clients, both financially and personally? You know, it's important to know why you do the things that you do. And when you're sitting eyeball to eyeball with a client and you're asking those hard questions and getting them to to deal with the issues that Mel was talking about in his great presentation. You know, do you have a philosophy? Do you really understand why you do what you do? The second thing is, do you have an understanding of your purpose, your passion? What life is all about for you? You know, as I look around the room, you know, I see a pretty eclectic group here. Some of you seem to be about the same age as I am or older, and some of you seem to be, you know, a lot younger. But, you know, what happens is what I've found is that I've gotten older and older. You know, those questions start to become much more relevant and pertinent, especially when you realize that the finish line isn't too far away. What about finances? You know, how much is enough? You know, if you can't answer that question for yourself, how are you going to answer that for your clients? And what I've discovered, and maybe you have as well, most of the agents in this industry are not particularly financially secure or savvy. You know, they're not doing a particularly good job with their money. So from a hypocrisy perspective, shouldn't we as leaders, you know, as leaders of our clients, as leaders of our families, as leaders in the community, be doing a better job financially? Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, we have to give up and quit, obviously. It just means we've got to employ principles of financial success and start utilizing those principles that we're trying to get other people to do in our own lives. And when we start doing those, amazing things start to happen. What about relationships? You know, where do we get, you know, fed? What type of relationships do we have? A lot of people are, you know, what we might call, mile wide and an inch deep. Other people are, you know, a mile deep and an inch wide. But, you know, if you're not digging deep into, you know, one or two or three lives, if you're not plowing significantly into relationships, you know, where do we get our fulfillment? Where is our fulfillment coming from? Our personal well-being, you know, physical fitness, you know, some type of an exercise program. You know, we talk about that all the time. and then what I guess I probably learned more than anything else, you know, one of these days I want to write a book called Everything That I Learned About Life I Learned in Rehab from our kids. But, you know, it was an amazing revelation to me to understand that I was not in control. I was not in control of anything. The only thing that I could control was me. You know, I could control my reactions. I could control how I responded to my circumstances. But I could not control how other people felt and what other people did and how other people made decisions. And then finally, I had to reassess my spiritual priorities. I had to make sure that, you know, I really understood who was in control of my life and that I was not in control of, you know, of the ultimate sovereignty of issues in my life. So, as a result of that, you know, I've spent the last 25 years investing a lot more in my children, both financially as well as emotionally. And if any of you are investing financially in your children, you know what I mean. You know, I've invested in having a healthy marriage, invested in serving others, helping others, you know, being involved. You know, we started a school, active in the church, you know, MDRT, a couple of missions in our community that I'm on the board of. But, you know, doing more than just staying focused on my own life. You know, probably my biggest goal ever is, you know, have you all heard the definition of an entrepreneur? That's a person who has a special relationship with the end of the month. You know, I mean, I got to make payroll. You know, these dear people, I see my job more than anything else as supporting the people who have supported me all these years. I mean, that's my number one objective in business is to make sure there's enough money there that I don't miss payroll. When's payroll? Isn't it coming up here soon? And then, of course, to make a difference. you know, to truly make a difference in the lives of others. So this is a little story that I heard not too long ago, and I think it's worth spending a few minutes going through. This is the story of Hot Chocolate. It starts out about a small group was meeting in a coffee shop, and they were sitting around, and they were talking. And they were, what they were visiting on was, you know, what life was all about. And this older gentleman came walking in, and they decided that they would engage him in a conversation. And so they decided to visit with him and hope that he would give them some inspiration and some wisdom. And so during that visit, they began to complain, you know, about life. Have you ever done that? Have you ever complained about, you know, the things that are going on, the economy, the politics, you know, all the various aspects of those things that we just can't seem to control? So they talked about the financial concerns, that, you know, the commission checks were too small, they had a couple of lapses, something didn't get through underwriting, you know, or they complained about their lives and their relationships. And about, oh, after a little while, the old man signaled Ethel, the waitress, and said, why don't you bring out some drinks here for your friends? So she brought out some hot chocolate. And she brought out a big pot of hot chocolate along with an assortment of cups. And there were porcelain cups, there were glass cups, crystal cups, there were some plain-looking cups, some expensive ones, some inexpensive ones, and he invited them all to have a cup of hot chocolate. So when each one had a cup and they poured the hot chocolate, he said to them, you know, did you notice which cup you picked? Now some of you picked, most of you picked the nicest cup you could find, the most expensive cups. None of you took these plain, old, cheap ones here, these ones that didn't look very good. He says, but it's normal to take the best cups from an assortment like that. It's just kind of our human nature. But as I've listened to you, as I've listened to the complaints, I would suggest that the source of your problems and stress is the cup, not the chocolate. That cup in your hand, the cup in your hand, adds nothing to the taste. It doesn't add anything to the quality of the hot chocolate. What it does is it just holds the chocolate. The cup is just nothing more than an expensive piece of porcelain, and sometimes it distracts you from your drink. So when Ethel brought out the chocolate, all you really wanted was something to drink. You didn't want the cup, but you unconsciously went for the best cups. And after a bit, I noticed you began to even look at each other's cups. Now, I've enjoyed our time together, he told them. He said, but please consider this, that hot chocolate's like your life. It's like your job, your money, peer pressure. Those are the cups. And the cups are just tools. They hold and contain your life. And the cup in no way defines or changes the quality of your life. And if you concentrate only on the cup, you fail to enjoy the chocolate. The life God has provided for you is the chocolate. So remember this, the hot chocolate is a gift. It's a gift from God. But he lets you choose your cup. Happy people don't necessarily have the best cups, but they enjoy the chocolate that's in it, and every drop of it typically. So they make the best of every, so make the best of everything you have. Live simply, love generously, care deeply, speak kindly. Live with integrity, love with passion, care for those who are needy, and be gentle and patient. And remember, the greatest of these is love. See, what I learned was that if I do the work, I can trust God for the results. And that the richest person is not the one who takes the most, but the one who needs the least. So enjoy your hot chocolate.